Reporting on politics and public policy is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Dusty Johnson has taken his seat in Washington as South Dakota's newest congressman. He has now been appointed as ranking member of the House Agriculture Subcommittee on Nutrition Oversight and Department Operations. This selection ensures Congressman Johnson is in place to oversee implementation of parts of the newest farm bill, and he's in Mitchell today. He joins us on the phone. Congressman Johnson, how are you?
Lori, I'm doing great.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the transition. Tell us about your office. What were you able to find a spot in? Tell us a little bit of history there.
Yeah, well, we are on fifth floor of Longworth, and there are three House office buildings. You know, Longworth is probably the one that is least grand. They built it on the cheap back in the early 1930s. And, you know, it's the best congressional office I've ever had. Of course, seniority is a major driver of how things are done in Washington. So the long-tenured folks get their pick of offices first, and you work your way down to the freshmen. It's only 840 square feet, which is less than 30 by 30, of course. So that's not a lot of room for 10 people to be in there. But we picked that office because it's where the House Ag Committee is also located on third floor Longworth. We didn't know if we were going to get on the Ag Committee, but we wanted to be close to the action in case we scored a seat.
All right. So who has been there before? Do you know anything about the history of that space?
I did look through, you know, I had asked for a list from the architect of the Capitol of everybody who has been in that space, hoping that there was, you know, a South Dakotan who'd been operated out of that office or maybe some great legislative leader. There has not been. You get kind of a new face in there every two or four years because it's not great space. People have a tendency to move out of there pretty quickly. But listen, it's way more important the type of work we're doing rather than where we're doing it. So we are about as happy as we can be.
It seems a little fitting, doesn't it, to sort of come and not have the grandness of remind you of South Dakota a little bit in its practicality.
Yeah, and I think we are trying to, we got a good number of South Dakotans in that office who are working there every day, and we are trying to figure out the best way to decorate that office so it has that South Dakota feel. Right now I've got a Harvey Dunn up in my office and a beautiful picture of Dignity there on the Missouri River Bluffs at Chamberlain. We got a little room to add a little more South Dakota vibe, and we're really looking forward to it.
All right, you mentioned the Ag Committee, so let's talk about your new placement and the subcommittee as well. How did this all transpire?
It took a lot of hustle, Lori. I was nervous we would not get a seat on the Ag Committee. It was one of the most in-demand committees, and they didn't have a lot of spots. You know, moving from the majority to the minority, as the House Republicans have done, meant that they lost a lot of seats on some key committees. Now, they only had three House Republicans on the Ag Committee lose their races or retire, but they lost more than three seats, slots on the committee. And so they were actually long quite a number of members. There were 11 freshman Republican who wanted seats on the committee that, again, didn't exist. So the odds were kind of stacked against us, but they made the decision that four senior members would roll off or go to other committees, which did leave some room for us. So getting on the Ag Committee was a big get. And then in what has been the most pleasant surprise I've had last month, we were named the ranking member or the top Republican on the subcommittee that will do two critically important things. I mean, first off, it's a subcommittee that has jurisdiction over SNAP or food stamps. And that is an area that I care a great deal about. We talked about it during the campaign on an almost weekly basis. It's something I have, you know, a firsthand connection to. And it's going to be a real honor, I think, to help, you know, guide our country's conversation about how that program can be improved. And then secondly, one thing that the House Democrats have done is, it used to be that all of these various subcommittees at the for the Agriculture Committee did their own oversight. They have concentrated all of that oversight authority into this one committee, the Nutrition and Oversight Committee. So when it comes to the critically important implementation of the Farm Bill, which will be one of the most important things that all of Congress will do over the course of the next year. That is all going to be done at that oversight subcommittee level. To be the top Republican on that and to be a freshman, that is an opportunity to serve South Dakota that I never dreamed we would have before us.
So to be clear, it's not just oversight of the SNAP portion of the Farm Bill. It's oversight of the whole omnibus legislation.
Yes, and in fact, it's not even just the Farm Bill. It's any time there's an oversight issue related to the U.S. Department of Agriculture or agriculture issues, that committee is going to have jurisdiction over it, that subcommittee.
Mm. Tell us about some of those first steps in making changes in the SNAP program. What do you think can be done better? What are you looking forward to tackling?
Right. Well, first I would say nobody should be starving in this country. And, you know, we are a country that's prosperous enough where we can afford to have a safety net that helps people who are in a position where they can't help themselves. And that is, I think it's a proud American tradition, and it's something we need to maintain. We also want to acknowledge the real dignity of work and the reality that for most people who are able-bodied, non-seniors, without children, because that's really been the focus of a lot of the reform efforts, able-bodied non-seniors without children at home. The way they're going to improve their lives is through work or training. And it is not going to be the receiving of food stamps that's going to improve their life as much as it is going to be making sure that they're also held accountable and that we're giving them opportunities to improve their life, which is going to mean, getting a job. Or if there aren't jobs in your area, making sure that you have access to really effective training programs or other educational opportunities. That's the way you make people's lives better. And I'm really driven by that value, and I'm looking forward to try to make sure we get it closer to perfect as a country.
Tell me a little bit about some of, folks back in South Dakota were talking about the government shutdown and how they were waiting for some things in the Farm Bill to sort of happen. There were lots of delays. Obviously, many people who were government contractors, for example, were encouraged, even after the shutdown was over, to go to a food bank to find some free food resources because they weren't going to get the back pay as contractors that they had hoped. Tell me, what has the view from Washington been as you connect with people in South Dakota and sort of see things unfold about the recently ended government shutdown? And then we'll talk a little bit about preventing another one.
Well, I mean, mine is the first freshman class to ever be sworn in during a shutdown. And it was a little surreal. I mean, you get excited. I mean, for 18 months, you tell South Dakota about, I mean, I told South Dakota about what I wanted to see our government do. And to show up in the midst of a partial shutdown, it was disappointing. I mean, there can't be an American, there can't be a South Dakotan who felt like that's how negotiations should take place, with that kind of brinksmanship. So it was culturally, I'm glad that I was so irritated and that so many of my classmates were irritated, because I think for us, it's a real reminder that that does not have to be business as usual. I mean, for the old timers, they have seen shutdown after shutdown. I mean, we have not passed all of our budgetary bills on time, but four times in the last 40 years. So they're used to this level of dysfunction. For the 90 of us who are newbies, we came in even more irritated than we otherwise would have, because we had to come in during the shutdown. And there was a group of us freshmen, both Republicans and Democrats, from pretty far left to, very conservative, who were meeting regularly during the shutdown, talking about what we could do to try to drive this process a little closer to functional. And Maury, none of us are naive. I mean, we understand that being a freshman in the House does not give you a lot of authority on your own. But when you start banding together, I think you do have an opportunity to send a pretty strong message to legislative leadership that there's got to be a better way to do things.
Do you think after some of those sort of bipartisan meetings, and like you said, there were some very vocal Democrats who lean far left and others who spoke out, do you think that there is an opportunity there early days to form some of those connections that might be useful in the future as you talk about some of the very difficult issues facing our country?
Yes. Now, there are clearly some, not all of the 90 freshmen appear interested in being part of responsible governance. There are some who seem more like show horses. There are some who come to the House floor every day with their television makeup already on. They clearly revel in the media spectacle of it all. I would tell you the ones on both sides of the aisle that I have had the most meaningful conversations with are not the people who will knock you down to get to the television camera. They're the people who have read the briefing memos. They're the people who are talking to people back home every single day. They're the people who understand that you do have to find some common ground. None of us have to be happy, Lori, that we're in an era of divided government. Some of us will be, some of us won't be. But one thing we all have to acknowledge with eyes wide open, because it is inarguable, in the era of divided government, nothing happens unless you're willing to find some common ground. That is logically true. It can't be argued. And there are a number of people, particularly freshmen, who understand that, and they embrace the fact that whether that's comfortable or not, that is our job now.
Let's talk about common ground that might prevent a future government shutdown, and that's largely dependent on this conversation around immigration reform and secure borders and what happens next there. What does meaningful immigration reform look like? Do we have to narrow the conversation down so that we can make one step at a time? Does it broaden the conversation? How do you see it?
Well, it has been a pretty narrow conversation, at least heretofore. When the president, I guess it was a couple Saturdays ago now, when he, issued, what he viewed as a compromise package to Speaker Pelosi, it did have some concessions for people here under the DACA program. It had some concessions for people who were here under temporary protective status. But those are pretty narrow. It didn't address work visas. It didn't address, any kind of a legal status for the millions of people who are here outside of DACA or TPS. It didn't adjust chain migration. It didn't adjust the visa lottery. It was pretty narrow. And there has not been anything, if I've got one largest frustration, Lori, from my time in D.C. so far, it has been how little I think the speaker, who's clearly, Nancy Pelosi is smart and she is a strategic operator, and what she has done is historically significant. There are not very many people in the history of this country who have been elected speaker twice. Her caucus clearly has a lot of faith in her ability to lead. But she has not provided many. There have not been counteroffers. I know she's frustrated with the things that the president has put on the table. But I think at least in South Dakota, when somebody makes an offer that you don't agree with, it sort of becomes incumbent upon you to then counteroffer. And then it's incumbent upon them to counteroffer. And there has not been that kind of back and forth that I think is the sign of a healthy negotiation. So maybe, and I'm just speculating here, maybe the narrow conversation has been too narrow. Maybe the speaker wants to have it to be more of a large-scale conversation about immigration, but there has not been any sign of that publicly, and there has been no sign of that to me as a member of Congress, at least not yet.
Do you think a government shutdown, because you really, I think, saw the Democrats solidify around that area of we're not going to use government employees as pawns in this conversation, that's off the table. Do you think that's fair, or do you think a government shutdown is can be weaponized in that way effectively?
Well, and I wouldn't say that was a Democrat value any more than it was a Republican value. There were a number of times when the Republicans voted overwhelmingly to provide back pay to even during the shutdown would bring up amendments saying, hey, let's just give everybody back pay so they aren't pawns. Let's continue our negotiation. Let's take care of these guys and gals. And those amendments didn't go anywhere, which I understand. When you're in the minority of the House, I think you need to be a realist about the fact that the agenda is going to be set more by the speaker and her party. So I do think you're right. There is a widespread sense among members of Congress that this is not the way we should be running the government.
When you return home to South Dakota, you're spending some time in Mitchell. What are you hearing from South Dakotans? I know you're connected to them in Washington as well through your communication channels, but being on South Dakota soil, what are people telling you?
Well, and I would start by saying I think it's one of the most important things a member of Congress can do. I mean, I talked to some of my colleagues, particularly those who have been there a long time, and they, you can tell they're kind of hunkered down. They don't, they know that we're in an uncomfortable time, and they, I think, are so concerned about, I don't know if they're concerned about getting yelled at or if they don't like that discomfort, but they are kind of hiding out. And I think that's the worst thing to do. I think you have got to be talking to real people. When I'm in D.C., as you alluded to, I'm diligent and deliberate about it. I'm making calls every single night to people who've called in. I'm trying to connect with them, hear what they're saying. In some respects, you're also right that the more valuable interaction sometimes can be when I'm back in South Dakota because they're not planned, they're not deliberate. These are not people who've called into the office. These are just real folks you bump into. I mean, yesterday afternoon, I was at the welcoming home ceremony for the 114th Fighter Wing. And there were, gosh, I bet there were almost 1,000 people there. And it was exciting to be able to welcome them home. But it was also exciting to just stand around in the back, talk to them as people came up. And people are not, it's not going to surprise you, Lori. People have this deep sense that if you took a fairly liberal South Dakotan and a fairly conservative South Dakotan, they would have very different worldviews. But if you locked them in a room for 2 hours and told them to come up with a deal, that they would come out with a deal. And I think there's widespread confusion and irritation that it doesn't work like that in D.C.
We are looking at a State of the Union address from President Trump this week. I think it's tomorrow. And what do you, are you going to be there in Washington for that speech?
I will be, yeah. We fly out tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., get to D.C., make sure we're there in time for a pretty full day of meetings. And of course, in the evening, we will have the State of the Union address. I'm hopeful, the president will probably say a couple of provocative things because almost every president does. I mean, if they're going to go give an hour-long address, there are going to be some more pointed messages there. That would be very typical. And those are generally the topics that gather the most attention in the media aftermath. That's not generally what I listen for. What I'm really listening for tomorrow is, does the president indicate any kind of a vision around some common ground in two areas, infrastructure and then trade? I would like to see movement on both of those fronts. And if we can get some of that out of the speech, that will be a very welcome news.